Good evening, everybody, in the hall, which is not many tonight, and maybe there's more online, but there's no surprise that it's a small crowd tonight with the mask wearing and the heat. Anyway, we can still have a good session. So my name's Drew Bellamy, and I'm giving the speech tonight after the meditation on right effort. This is part of the series on the Eightfold Path that I'm doing. This is number 6. All the other talks are online on YouTube if you're curious. So we'll start with a 30-minute guided meditation, and then about a 25-minute talk, and then I guess Q&A will be much shorter tonight. And for those who are watching online overseas, at the moment it's pretty hot in Perth. We're on our second heat wave of the summer. This is day 2 or 3 of over 40 degrees, and there's a few more to go. Interesting times. Okay, so we'll just dive straight into the guided meditation. So we might just... I'm not sure if we'll dim the lights. Paul, do you know how to dim the lights up the back? Yeah, thanks. Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. Oh, that's it. That'll do. That'll do. So, okay. So let's close our eyes and just get comfortable in the seating position. I always find it's a better meditation if you spend more time wriggling around at the start and getting ready. Than trying to jump straight in and not having such a good meditation because you're uncomfortable. So we'll start with a body sweep and then we'll go to the breath, and I'll guide the body sweep. So just starting on our feet, wriggling our toes, feeling our toes. Feeling our feet, if they're planted on the ground, or if just our heels are on the ground. I'm just thinking that this is making us grounded for a meditation. Then coming up to our calves, just giving them a little flex, just acknowledging that they're there. And all the work they do all day carrying us around. Just feeling if they're a little bit tight or not. Maybe just flex them a few times and see if you can get a bit of a stretch. And coming up to our knees. Just feeling if there's any pains or niggles in our knees, common as we get older. And if there is, not being bothered by it, just focusing on it for a minute, just being aware of any sensations there. And then coming up to our thighs, maybe give them a little twitch and just feel that they're there. And moving on to our lower back. Maybe just giving a little move in the chair and just making sure it's comfortable. Checking for any sensations or any niggles or pains. Just be aware and focus on that. And coming up to our stomachs, Just checking if there's any tension. It's a place you can hold tension if you're a bit stressed out. And if you think there is, just a big out breath. Letting that tension go. And coming up to our chest. Another place we can hold tightness. Just breathing more deeply than usual and just feeling, is there any tightness in the chest? Are we holding any emotions there? Can we let it go with the out-breath? And feeling our hands and our palms. Are they sweaty? Are they relaxed? Are they comfortable in our lap? Checking our arms on our legs. Are they comfortable? And then coming up to our shoulders. Are they tight? Can we take a few breaths and let them sag down? If there's any tension, let the tension have a reprieve just for a minute. And coming up to our neck. How are the neck muscles? Tight? Are they loose? Can we take a breath into them? And out. And coming to our face. Is there any tension around our mouths? Any tightness from the day, from all the talking? Can we let that tension down? Is there any tension around our eyes? Can we breathe into that and let it go? And how does it feel between our eyes on our forehead? Are we scrunching it up? Is it tight? Or can we breathe out, relax, let it go? And then finally, the top of our scalps. Can we focus on it and be aware? A body part we never think of. Maybe there's even a tingling sensation as you focus on your scalp at the top of your head, pointing to the sky. And then finally sweeping back down the body, back down from the head to the shoulders, to the chest, to the legs, to your feet. Just taking a deep breath. And maybe now we're a bit more aware of our body, a bit more grounded with our feet. We can come to the nose. Coming to the nose. Can we take a deep breath and feel the breath coming in through the nose? Feel it filling the chest. And then feel it come out the nose. In. Out. As if the tip of the nose was the edge of the world. Focusing on the tip of the nose and feeling the breath, being mindful of the breath. Can we take three extra deep breaths, feeling it come through the nose to really relax ourselves? And settling into a rhythmic, moderate awareness of the breath. If you're breathing long, be aware, I'm breathing long. If you're breathing short, be aware, I'm breathing short. Not being attached to any thoughts that come and go as we monitor the breath. Like the breath, the thoughts come in, we don't engage, and they go out. Just gently guiding our attention to the tip of our noses, following the breath sensation. thoughts come and go. Letting sounds come and go. Coming back to the breath. Relaxing with the breath. Being aware of each breath in and out. Maintaining focus on the breath. And as we come towards the end of the meditation, just making sure that we're checking in with the breath, not being distracted, just enjoying the breath, the relaxation. In a minute I'll ring the gong, and on the third ring we can open our eyes and end the meditation. In between now and then, just check in with yourself and discover if you are more relaxed, and the meditation has worked or not. Okay, and just like that, boom, half an hour gone. Good way to spend half an hour though. So if anyone who's just joined us online and skipped the meditation, I'll just do a quick introduction again. My name's Drew Bellamy. I'm a former president of the Buddhist Society. I'm a businessman and a layman battling away in lay world. And I'm doing a series of talks on the Noble Eightfold Path. And tonight's talk, number six, is on right effort. We have a much smaller crowd than usual in Perth tonight because of the weather and the coronavirus, I think. But there's quantity and there's quality, so I'm sure tonight's audience is the quality audience. Okay, so right effort sits in sixth place on the Eightfold Path, and that doesn't mean it's the sixth most important thing or the third last or third most important thing. It means that all parts of the path have to be developed sort of in conjunction at once, and depending on your personality, some parts of the path will be easier for you, say mindfulness, than other parts, maybe right action. And that's all quite natural. The key is just to make sure that, literally, you put the right effort into the different parts of the path to give you the best chance of making some spiritual development. And how do you know you're making spiritual development? Well, possibly your life's a little bit smoother and you're developing wisdom. And this is a difficult thing in lay world. I've been on the Noble Eightfold Path for 15, 20 years now, and different times of your life, different parts of the path are easier. So before I had a family, meditation was quite good for me, literally because I didn't have all the chaos going on that comes with family life. And, you know, since that's come along, the meditation for me hasn't been as good. However, other parts of the path have become more illuminated because of the struggles that I've had to overcome. Other parts of the path have been better. So, yeah, don't be disheartened if you're not doing everything at once, or in some part of your life you find that a certain part of the path that is not so good. And a big one in lay world is meditation. People generally come to the Buddhist Society and go, right, that's it, I'm going to be a meditation guru, and really go for it. And, you know, that's all they talk about, and compare themselves to monks and whatever else. And then the reality can be quite different. But there's no need to be disheartened, and you just have a go at everything you can, as much as you can. And that's putting in right effort. So I would say that right effort. So I've done a bit of reading, and I've got three suttas that I've just going to briefly talk about, and then their application in daily life in the modern age. But reading around the suttas, right effort doesn't get as much treatment from the Buddha, it seems, besides something like mindfulness or meditation or right action. But I came to realise that's because it's not unimportant. It's actually, I think it's quite subtle. And to be honest, I've been in the Buddhist world for 15, 20 years. And until I knew that I was doing this talk a few weeks ago, I hadn't really considered right effort too much. I've been focusing on right speech and action and right view, which is the first step and quite important. But I'd never considered right effort. I thought, oh, right effort, that just means get down to the meditation hall and get on the cushion and go for it. But it doesn't, as it turns out, as I found out to my embarrassment over the last few weeks. From what I've read in the suttas, right effort could be summarised as the motivation for the practice. And if you look at it in that way, if you don't have motivation or the right effort to do the practice, then the practice is going nowhere. So in a subtle way, right effort's very important, and now seems quite obvious. So the first sutta I'll just do a little reading from, and I think this is sort of the authority on right effort, is from the Nikaya, the Samudaya Nikaya 45, number 8, if anyone ever remembers that. It's called Analysis of the Eightfold Path, and this is the sutta, the sort of father sutta of the Eightfold Path, and the Buddha's talking to, who's he talking to? I'll just have a quick look. I've just got a little photocopy of it here from my books at home. And right, so he's talking to some monks, he goes through the whole of the path and gives a summary of each one and of each aspect. And then I'll just read this word for word. It's quite short. And what, monks, is right effort? Here, monks, a monk or layperson generates a desire for the non-arising of unrisen evil, unwholesome states. He makes an effort arousing energy, applies his mind and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of unwholesome states. He generates the desire for the arising of wholesome states. He generates desire for the continuation of wholesome states, for their non-decline, for their increase, for their expansion, and for their fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. So by the Buddha putting it into the context of striving to decline unwholesome and incline wholesome states, he's really talking about the whole of the Eightfold Path. And so he's saying right effort is the desire to correctly manifest and develop yourself along the Eightfold Path. And he then talks about a way, the way in which this is done, and this is the next sutta that I read on right effort. And in this one here, it's in the Anaguttara Nikaya, and it's in the Book of Sixes. And this sutta is simply called, it's under the Great Chapter. and here, the Buddha's talking to a layman about right effort and in the context of arousing the correct energy and how to make it easier for self on the Eightfold Path with all the other factors to get your development right. So he's talking to this layman called... it was a monk, Sonya, venerable monk. So this monk was trying as hard as he could in the Buddhist Sangha, and he considered himself the most energetic, hard-working monk, but he wasn't developing spiritually like he thought he might be able to. And of course, the name of the game for the monks is to get enlightened, and he knew that he was nowhere near that and getting a bit frustrated. So he had a chat to the Buddha. And then, this is quite a long chat, but I'll just take out this paragraph here. And so the Buddha says, Sonya, in the past when you lived at home, weren't you skilled at playing the lute? So the lute, I think, is like a ancient Indian guitar. yes, Bhante. What do you think, Sonya? When its strings were too tight, was the lute well-tuned and easy to play? No, Bhante. When its strings were too loose, was your lute well-tuned and easy to play? No, Bhante. So, Sonya, when its strings were neither too tight nor too loose, but adjusted to a balanced pitch, was your lute well-tuned and easy to play? Yes, Bhante. And so too, Sonya, if energy is aroused too forcefully, this leads to restlessness. And if energy is too lax, this leads to laziness. Therefore, Sonya, resolve on a balance of energy, achieve evenness through your spiritual facilities and take up your object there. So I don't know if he's talking about objects of meditation, that sutta goes on. But so the Buddha's giving the advice here that in regards to right effort, it's sort of almost like the Goldilocks Three Bears story of don't go too hard, but don't be too lazy, and I guess bring in some mindfulness of your capabilities and your energies, and go the middle path, which is one of the big tenets of Buddhism. And in fact, the Buddha, before he became enlightened, he spent a lot of time as an ascetic doing crazy practices in the jungles of India 2,500 years ago, starving himself to the point where there's a sutta where he was saying that he could get his finger, put it on his stomach and touch his spine. He was so emancipated. And he came to realize that was too much effort. And so he swung back, he eased up a bit and swung back into the middle, and then eventually gained enlightenment. So, whether you're a monk or a layperson, I think right effort is all about being mindful of your abilities and your other demands in life, and then applying the correct amount of energy. Because obviously, if you go too hard too quick, you burn out. And at the Buddhist Society over the years, I've seen so many people come in and just go hard. Typically, they start off with meditation. They go hard on that, and then they realize that it's not getting them as far or as fast as they wanted to. And then they delve a bit deeper into Buddhism, and then generally they start to get a bit crazy around right action and right speech, and they really take it to a level where they're actually not functioning that well in society, and people are saying, oh, what's wrong with this person? You know, they're trying to be the holiest, almost pseudo-monk type thing, but they're in lay clothes, and it doesn't work, and then they get into trouble, and then they get disillusioned. And you know, there's a reason that the monks are in the monastery, and that whole system is geared up for them to go as hard as they can. But in lay world, we have to realize that there's limitations to the progress in our practice because of the constraints put on us by, you know, work and family and all the other things that go on. And if you can just accept this, and accept that it's not a fast race, it's not a marathon for a layperson. I think it's more like a power walk. So you're definitely going somewhere, and you're definitely putting in the effort, and there is going to be results. But it's a long-term undertaking, and you've got to put the right effort in, not be too crazy and hardcore, and obviously not be too lazy, but just tick along bit by bit, consistently engaging with the Dharma. You know, when I started out in Buddhism, I was coming down to this Dharma hall every Friday night. Like, I was going for it in my 20s. And even I started to burn out and thought, oh, I can't do another Dharma talk. It's too much. I cannot take another one of H.R. Pram's jokes. No offense, H.R. Pram, they're good jokes, but it's too much of a good thing. And I backed off on coming down to Dharma Loka for a while, and it worked. I got hungry again to hear some Dharma, and then started to come at a more moderate pace, and it was good. So that's just an aside on advice I'd give for people who have realized that there is something in Buddhism for lay people, and it is worth doing, but pace it out and sort of be realistic about your expectations. And the third sutta, which I don't have a copy of here, is the Anaguttara Nikaya, number 830-4, if anyone's going to remember that. And the Buddha's again, I think this time he is talking to a layperson from memory. I haven't written it down. The Buddha was good. He a lot of the big suttas, like the real deep spiritual stuff, of course he was talking to the monks, but it went on the public record, and it could be accessed by any monk or layperson, although they weren't writing records in those days, but people were memorizing and reciting. And actually, the suttas weren't written until after the Buddha died. So as I understand it, in the Sangha, different monks were responsible for remembering different parts of his teaching. And then after he died, they had this great council and sort of got together and said, all right, what are we going to do about Buddhism? And they decided to write things down, and these monks all contributed the stories that they had memorized from Buddha, and then out of that we got the suttas. And then the suttas were sent to China, and then later on they made their way north of India to places like Tibet, and they were separated. Those copies of the suttas were separated for something like 1,500 years or more, and they never crossed. And then when the British went around conquering the world in the 1800s, their archaeologist type people, anthropologists, whatever they're called, sociologists, they got copies of the Indian, Sri Lankan and Chinese, and had them translated back into English. And Ajahn Brahmali is the expert on this, but I think it's something like there's not more than a 2 or 3% divergence between the two suttas in the different languages. And that just goes to show that in Buddhism, there's a tradition down the centuries of not messing with the texts and changing the story and adding things in. So it it really gives an authenticity and confidence, I think, in the suttas. Because I know that with the Bible, I'm not bagging out Christianity, and I was brought up in a Christian school and that, that the different versions that went from, I think the first one was Hebrew and then Greek and then Latin and then English, they change quite a bit between each one, and it sort of makes you suspicious about what was added in at a later date in retrospect and how authentic some of it might be. But the Buddhist texts stand up to archaeological scrutiny, so that's good for your confidence. So anyway, in this particular sutta, he just quite simply says to this person that, I think this person was struggling with the Dharma and they wanted to get into it, and he said that the Dharma is, for one, not too restless or not too lazy, but one who wants to pursue spiritual development. So again, it's similar to that sutta about the loot. He's saying, you know, you've got to put in the effort, you've got to attend to the whole of the Eightfold Path, and you have to do it. You have to do it in a balanced manner. So that was my very short tonight talk on right effort. I was mindful of keeping it at about 20 minutes because I had a message from the organisers of this series that they want to have the meditation and then the talk and then the Q&A and then at 8 o'clock we're heading across for a cup of tea at the end. So I did want to then reserve the last 10 minutes for a Q&A. So that includes people online who can send their questions through to the audiovisual team and I can answer them off the iPad. And also from, obviously, first we hope to start off with the people in the hall tonight. I know there's not many people here and maybe that might make you a bit shy, but please do, if you have a question, ask it, because other people are going to learn from you asking the question. And we do get some good, interesting questions. So I would put the subject matter, first of all, at right effort. But if you had any other questions on Buddhism, ask them as well. Any curiosities you've got from possibly other aspects of the path I've talked about in the other talks, or a question about your own practice, or why do the monks shave their head? So we'll call it a Q&A, AMA, question and answer, and ask me anything. So, do we have in the 10 minutes? Do we have any questions from the floor? There must be one. Come on! Don't be out done by the people online. Any questions, like what time does the monastery open? How many years will it take me to get enlightened? Anything. Oh. Does anyone want to come up and give a Dharma talk then? And I'll start asking some questions. Okay then, so we'll do a question from Canada. This one is Q from Canada. Why does the ego come back? Okay, so this could be two things. It could be, are they talking about rebirth, or are they talking about when you do a meditation or attain some development? Does the ego come back? Okay, so what is the ego? I guess the ego is, my interpretation is that ego is the part of you that wants desire to be fulfilled. I think that's what the ego is. The desire to be wanted or famous or important. And I guess you could say that's an unwholesome state, like the Buddha was talking about. And as I understand it, to be fully spiritually developed, you don't have an ego. So the arahants, the ones who are very few in number and have reached full spiritual development, the reason that they don't go back into rebirth is because they've extinguished the desire for things, and that's part of the noble four truths, that there's unsatisfaction or suffering in the world, and the reason that occurs is because of attachment to things or desires, and desires just usually lead to more desires, and then the third and fourth is that there is a way to lessen attachment or desires, and the fourth one is that's the Eightfold Path, and the reason that the attachment to these desires leads to suffering is because you achieve a desire, and then we live in an impermanent world, and then that desire is then unsatisfied because the condition has changed, and then the desire comes back. Right, well, you know, I now have last year's Ferrari model, for instance, and there's a new model, so I need the new one. So the ego quite simply exists because of our desires, which is a very natural state. But unfortunately, it just gets us into a lot of trouble. And for lay people, the main part of the Eightfold Path is lessening unwholesome states. And unwholesome states occur because of desires, and they lead you by the nose into the wrong direction. And then if you can do that, you can create more space, I suppose, and more tranquility for reflection, which then leads to insight, which then leads to wisdom. And then once you've gained wisdom in conjunction with, assuming that mindfulness is part of wisdom, in conjunction with the higher meditation states or samadhi, you then get the deepest insights. You're able to cut off the desires and the fetters, and then you're fully spiritually developed. So, Q from Canada, the ego will keep coming back because it's linked to the desires, and especially in the modern world, it's very hard to extinguish them because it's everywhere. TVs, you know, sensuality and movies and magazines and whatever else is just part and parcel of lay life. And all I can say is, maybe just focus your mind in the right directions and think about what you can do on the path, and that will reduce your desires, and therefore, I guess, reduce your egos. And the typical hallmark of a spiritually developed person is they seem to have, on the surface anyway, a lack of ego. There's another question here. Oh, they're popping in. Looks like we'll fill up the remaining minutes. From Mark, when you start to apply right effort with the Dharma, does that start to transfer into other areas like work? Absolutely. Even if you think about how we talked about the suitor with the lute and the Buddha saying not too tight, not too not too loose, and you'll get the right tune on the guitar. It's obviously the same thing in the workplace or at your family life. And if you can wisely examine the Eightfold Path and look at balance, then you're going to get better results at work and in your family life as well. Like, it's all interconnected. There are, as I've learned the very hard way in my life, there's no hard boundaries between the different aspects of your life. They all flow into each other. And so if you're doing good things and you're doing good spiritual things, I know it firsthand, it flows into other aspects of your life. Because you just become a better person. You become easier to get along with. And it's just a better vibe. On the other hand, I've also personally experienced it and paid the price. When you're doing the wrong thing in one part of your life, it has knock-on effects in the other part of your life. So I would apply right effort on the Eightfold Path. I would apply that same thinking and modus, as you should, into other parts of your life, and hopefully things become a bit easier for you. I wish I'd taken my own advice many years ago. But anyway, here we are now. Third question. Why these ones don't have people's names? Is there at AV doesn't? Oh, they don't put their names on there. Oh, okay. So this question could be from outer space. No name, no location. Why does anyone need to follow a religion or spirituality? Why can't one live in complete freedom without having to follow anyone or anything? Good question. Two aspects. First of all, human beings are tribal animals that generally need some form of structure and social hierarchy. And so from a psychological safety point of view, that'd be one reason why you might follow a religion or spirituality. The second reason would be that quite simply, one person can't know everything that's out there. And schools, universities, religion, spiritualities, they structure and distill and hold that information there for you. So I did a couple of degrees, but I did a geology degree at university, and studying this geology degree, all the time they would be referring these scientific principles and experiments back. Oh, and in the 1990s we discovered this. Oh, and after 40 years of work in the 1960s, this particular scientist had this breakthrough. Oh, in the 1800s, they worked out the thing about dinosaurs and whatever. And you just, you know, people's lifetimes of work and institutions going for generations with people in them accumulating this knowledge and distilling it and presenting it into a format where you can learn it much quicker in just one sitting than they spent their whole lives doing it. And it's the same for spirituality. I find it difficult to call Buddhism a religion. I suppose it is, but it's the same in Buddhism. Like, there's thousands of pages of suttas and texts from the Buddha, and I still haven't, probably won't get all the way through them. And all the time when I go back and do a bit of reading every now and then, I come across some great little story or insight that, even though I've been practicing for 15, 20 years, I never would have come of it on my own. So there's value in aligning with a spiritual practice, because it can give you sort of shortcuts, and we've only got limited time on this planet. And the other thing about that the Buddha recommends in regards to spirituality or religion is he says that there's lots of important factors, but one of the most important factors for developing yourself on the Noble Eightfold Path, outside of the individual components of action and mindfulness and effort, is good comradeship. And he basically says, unless you're with all the time or part of the time other people who are in the Dharma, who you can sort of bounce off and learn from and encourage each other, the Buddha says it's just nigh on impossible. The better the teachers you have and the better friends you have in the Dharma, the more of a boost you're going to get in your personal practice. And on the flip side, he says, if you're hanging out with criminals and the thugs and all the rest of it, you're going downhill very quickly, and then of course you're going to end up in jail or dead, which is all quite logical when you think about it. So that's why a place like Dharmaloka here is such a great centre or institution, because you can drop in and connect with like-minded people in the Dharma, and people practicing at all different levels and know different things, and it's good. It's very hard as a human being to be there out on your own alone. It's very difficult. That's why we all chase partners and families and social status, because that's really just how we're programmed. So why not use that and funnel it for your spiritual development? Of course, the tricky thing is not to get caught up in some crazy cult, or you know, sign up for jihad or whatever. that's the flip side, unfortunately, to institutions. So it's a good thing that Dharmaloka exists. It's a good thing that the Buddhist texts have been preserved, and they seem to be truthful. It's beneficial for all of us. So that's just about 8:05. I'll put out one more question. If someone had a question from the audience at Dharmaloka tonight, otherwise, if not, we'll wrap it up there. We'll just pay our respects to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and do three bows, and then anyone who's interested might just have a chat at the kitchen across the road. Thank you.